Knock, knock.
Who's there?
Mic test.
Mic test who?
Okay, we got it.
Yay!
My name is Kappa. What's yours?
Fantastic episode of Fangs and Fonts. Here we are with episode 19, Dialogue! Woo! In this corner, the spotted cheetah.
Yanara! Yeah,
yeah. In that corner, that spider-full thing voice.
Whoop, whoop.
In this corner, it's me, Ocean. And we're a triangle tonight because the other ferret isn't here.
He's in his own corner.
He's in his own corner of Texas. Watch for him on the latest Notcast.
He is.
So, hope you guys are doing great today. We've got a great episode for you. Sounds so corny saying that.
It really does.
Yeah.
Especially since we're all, you know, back and refreshed and cynical from our separate vacations.
Tonight, we're going to be talking about dialogue.
Something a lot of people seem to have issues writing, or at least it comes up at conventions.
Which is really confusing, but hey.
So do you talk to other people in your life?
Absolutely not. I am a shut-in furry that lives on the internet and
then
acts
you
like
probably should not write dialogue.
Well then, that's done with that.
But in case you are still that person, we're still going to give you some tips and tricks and talk about it.
Because quite frankly, dialogue is one of the most important aspects of writing.
It's incredibly easy to screw up too.
Incredibly easy. So, creating realistic dialogue.
What's the first step?
Don't do ahs. Not unless it's an effect.
How do you mean?
Well, when you talk to somebody, usually, if you have a general conversation, you get a lot of, if you write that, you're going to come off as a stuttering idiot.
Do you get a lot of people who do that?
Far too often.
Really?
Mm-hmm. I also work with a lot of accountants.
Well, it mostly goes with when you're trying to create realistic dialogue. The problem is that when most people end up talking, they put in pauses as their brain is trying to catch up or they're trying to think of the right words to use. In writing, unless it's a dramatic effect, putting those little things in there really kind of detracts from what you're trying to do with your characters. So one side, you're trying to be realistic about things, but the other hand, that's taking it too far because you're having someone sit there and go, whatever. And I'm sure you can hear it as we talk for this podcast. There's always going to be those pauses where we're trying to think of something.
Gather your thoughts, young one.
Well, with consulting, when you present to a client, it's been told to pause. If you're stuck on that word, instead of going, you should be, we would like to do this. Because it makes you sound better. It makes you...
Makes you sound a little more controlled and less like a stuttering twit. Which is a good... is suggested for most job interviews, too.
There was an episode of Quirks and Quarks. If you ever get an episode, a chance to watch or listen to it. And he was talking. It was one of their not talking about anything shows and just where they kind of wrapped things up. And he said, well, there's a lot of things that happen in an interview. A lot of the pauses that people do when they get talk, edited it out. Here's what those sound like. And it was about a 5-minute long blurb of just one interviewer's pauses while he's talking. And it's just a bunch of, And it makes you kind of sit there and realize just how often we do it as people. So when you're writing, unless you're actually wanting to show that pause in the dialogue, it's generally not recommended that you end up putting that in.
Otherwise, it's going to make your character sound like moronic idiots.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, if you want to have someone who's unsure and shaky, and that's their personality.
And that works perfectly for that, or an unsure or shaky situation. I know I take advantage of that fairly often.
That makes sense, but yeah, I haven't seen too much of that, so I can't really comment on reading it exactly, but it just sounds like something that'd be a waste of my time to have to read stuff.
Well, if you use it too often, I mean, it's like any other writing trick. It's use it sparingly.
Mm-hmm.
This ties into one of the things you'll always hear at conventions, and it's one of the pieces of advice that's always brought up when trying to learn to write dialogue is go to a public place like a coffee shop and sit there and listen to people talk.
Be a creeper and listen.
Even on the bus, even like today, I went to a local gaming store, and on the way back, I got to listen to this lady's phone conversation about how she got fired.
Ouch.
And she didn't care. She was laughing to her friend about it, and I guess her coworker reported her for something that she did that was apparently bad enough that she got fired for it. So she wasn't surprised. But just the dialogue itself...
It's quite the situation.
Yeah. Listening to it, you just pick up mannerisms of how people talk, because each one of us ends up talking differently. And just listening to people, you'll be able to start picking those up.
People watching is a great tool. I enjoy it.
It comes in handy for sure, more than just dialogue.
Mm-hmm. But I know for myself, I've done an exercise before where you go to a coffee shop and you write. But what you're really doing is listening to the people behind you and writing everything they say.
Next thing you know, you read what you've written and you go, oh my God, the people behind me are filthy.
And then I found out it was you guys.
Yeah, well.
But
so that just leads right into the, then you got to go back to the coffee shop and make friends with those people.
But it's interesting, the stuff that, like, I would not encourage you to overhear everyone's conversation, but do it as an exercise now and then and just
actually
listen to how people go back and forth.
There's a similar exercise in drawing, too. In figure class, they want you to go to a public place, usually a park, and do quick drawings of people in action.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really no different than, you know, go to a public place and take quick notes of people in conversation.
One of the things to take notice of, and this has been mentioned before on Unsheathed, is most conversation, especially person to person, is actually a dominance battle for people trying to overtop the other person. And when you're listening to other people through this, it's really interesting to just see those, especially at conventions. That's where I notice it happening the most, where people are trying to basically one up the other person, but just verbally through a normal conversation where that doesn't come up.
I kind of call it the party effect.
Mm-hmm.
Someone will tell a story and you'll be like, that's hilarious, you should hear this one. And then it just becomes everyone just telling more related stories that they're hoping will get as much attention, if not more, than the last.
But it's also things like cutting people off,
mm-hmm,
and talking over them.
Getting
the last word or things like that.
Nicely done.
Thank you. He still got the last word.
He did.
Yeah. But that's generally, and it's a give and take of points. And if anyone actually can find that episode of Unsheathed, I highly recommend you listen to it.
Or if we find it, we could post it on
the
Facebook.
It's the one where they interview their script writing teacher, and really funny guy. Really, like, it was at a convention and he was a guest of honor, or one of the guests there, and really funny guy, and they talk about that.
But what you're going into is that the dialogue should also be telling about your characters.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's dynamic.
Exactly. If you have a person who just wants to dominate people and be the person that feels important, they're going to be trying to get that last word, jutting in with what they want to say.
Titus the Coyote. See anything you like, ladies? But that's exactly it. And, I mean, if you want someone who's a bully, they're going to talk like a bully. They're going to cut people off. They're going to have a lot of M dashes where people are just, that's the end of the conversation, and the guy will start talking.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and their tones will be angry or aggressive.
Mm-hmm. Or at least louder.
Mm-hmm.
And not even just the whole, I'm using volume to talk loud, but, you know, it's that voice projection where the person just tries to be louder without yelling.
Yeah.
Now, pacing of dialogue.
That was actually really badly paced.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was.
But going back to, like, M dashes and even with stuttering and that, I find a lot of people like to use the ellipses as breaks and pauses and almost...
Instead of just an actual, honest-to-God, sentence end?
Yeah. Instead of something that should be just lightly sprinkled here and there... They're just like, but what if we went to the park?
Mm-hmm. Like Shatner?
Yeah, it gets Shatner syndrome very quickly.
And the worst part is Shatner doesn't even do that.
No, he's mocks like, it. Whatever.
That's a good point.
But it annoys me when people put, they seem to put pauses, and I hate when I'm reading something and there seems to be a pause in the middle and I'm confused why they've paused there. And then I read on, I'm like, why didn't they pause here? What are they deciding at this point that they've paused at? That they're not over here.
This makes no sense.
And part of the way of fixing that is, and a lot of people don't do it for dialogue and I don't understand it, is just read it out loud. Read it out loud like you're saying it. Because then you'll catch awkward pauses like that mm-hmm. in the middle of your sentence where it's they're talking, they pause, and you're just like, well, why are they...
Why did I stop there? I talk to myself often enough that I usually don't have a hard time with dialogue, so...
Like an example I'll say is, we should go to the kitchen instead of... I'll think, we should go to the kitchen.
One of those flows much more naturally than the other.
One also stresses on what they're trying to decide on as well. Because usually when someone pauses, they're thinking about what to say.
True. There's a, right? a circumstantial stressing in that.
Mm-hmm. And we should... There's a variety of actions you could do. Well, we should go to a variety of different places.
Or we should do a variety of different actions.
Also, do not confuse your ellipses with an m-dash, because those are two very different things as well.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people, like myself, I've only recently come accustomed to the m-dash, and I find it a fantastic tool now.
Mm-hmm.
And an ellipses is a pause, while an m-dash is an interruption. So, you know, we should go to the kitchen. We should go to the kitchen! You know.
Do it!
Very different two things.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of people use the pause as something that should be interrupted.
Yeah, no. And like you said, a lot of those things can be figured out if you just read your dialogue out loud. Even if you have to lock yourself in your room so no one else can hear you talking to yourself and adopt a goofy voice for one and your regular voice for the other, just so it sounds like a real conversation to your ears. You'll really do yourself a much, much needed favor for that.
And take account into the rate that you're saying it. If you find that one sentence, you had to take a breath halfway through, that's probably a place for a period, yeah, or at least
then you're
a comma.
Then you're looking at a run-on sentence and you've got some structure things to work on.
Mm-hmm.
Ugh, I came across one of those in a story I just started reading. And one of the criticisms a lot of the reviews were saying was that they had issues with run-on sentences. And the first page, third sentence in, and it goes on, and in this one sentence, he goes into two lists in that sentence, and there's about five things in each list. So, and it's just, I'm reading this, and it's half the paragraph in one sentence, and you're just like, why are you doing this?
Why would you do that?
For pacing and whatnot, what do you think about dialogues that take more than, say, one paragraph?
Like, I'm doing a speech?
Or yeah, it's a long, drawn out conversation between two people?
Well, not even
where
just
that. I'm narrating a story.
Well, because you know where the little used person starts a conversation, says something, you know, he does an action, the sentence continues.
Oh, so
and then it's a new
They're talking and movie at the same time?
Well, no, like, just... Okay. Like, so that you fill up enough that you have a nice, beautiful paragraph, but there's still dialogue that he has to talk, so you bring it into another paragraph.
Mm-hmm.
So it could be that he just said one giant paragraph of text, but usually they've done something as well on that. And it's the one where you don't close it with the...
Yeah, because if you're writing paragraphs of speech, then you're not supposed to close the end of the paragraph.
Yeah. But I mean, I've only ever done that in one story I've written. But for pacing wise, when you read something like that, what are your thoughts on that? Like, do you find them to be clunky or?
Well, if I go back to when the uses of this, I think are very few. So something like that comes straight to mind is a speech,
mm-hmm.
or they're narrating their own story, or, you know, telling a flashback or something. Usually someone needs some sort of... It seems like if you're going to be talking for a long time, it's usually centered around an experience. Otherwise, you're the really annoying person that won't shut up about your day and how I had a piece of toast and then I buttered the piece of toast and then I put jam on the toast and the toast was a little burnt, but it was still tasty. But afterwards, it went really down with juice and you're like, no, see, that's not important. Get the heck out.
Yeah.
So if I go back to my original premise, then I'm assuming that it's something that already is almost its own narrative. And so if you took it almost into another form of scope, it seems fine. Because it's like another story.
Yeah.
Inside a story. But if you go back to the previous example where they're just rambling on, then I'm going to get probably annoyed.
Start whiting out pieces of text on the paper.
I mean, like, you could do two sentences of what I did and then just... And they rambled on, you know?
Well, that goes into the whole realism conversation thing. Because in a lot of standard conversation, people will go off on tangents and whatnot. But when it comes to a story, you necessarily don't want to do that. You want to be very direct with what you're talking about in your story, because otherwise you're just going to end up losing your reader as your person goes on and starts rambling about, you know, their toast for the day when they're supposed to be talking about why they lost their plasma carbine in the...
Or why there's a dead body in the back alley.
Yeah, exactly.
Though, actually, it's the only time I've ever seen a good example of something like that was used for an effect when the character actually did find a dead body, and they were stressing that focusing on the main mundane points helped them from freaking out and losing their shit that they found a dead body. But at that point, they still didn't go on and on and on and on. They went on in the story, but they didn't give you the whole text.
But you as the reader figured out what was going on.
As the reader, I got a few sentences, and then the writer stated, if I focused on the mundane things, it kept me from realizing what actually happened and losing my shit, basically. Mm-hmm. And I, as a reader, didn't have to read three paragraphs of stupid.
Exactly.
So you can describe what's going on as a writer and not need all that flavor text. At that point, you just look like a twit who's trying to up your word count.
So in the regards of things like that, as well as listening to people talk, everyone has a unique voice when they're doing dialogue.
Some of them spike, some of them don't.
but going back to the long parts of paragraphs, like do you feel there's any other instances of that outside?
I've only really come across one episode, like one story in my mind where that I've only written one, and I've come across a couple, but they always feel clunky to me. Because if someone sat there and has enough time to speak for two paragraphs worth of dialogue, it better be damn important, because otherwise what's the point?
Like, I think I can think of two instances I've written where it'd be someone doing a long thing, but in one it was a narrator. And so there was no quotation marks. He was just narrating the premise of the story, telling this history of where we are now. And then the other one, it starts down with you sitting down at a bus stop, and this old man starts commenting on something with you and then goes into telling you this entire story. But he's even though he's dialoguing the entire story, it's not in quotation marks because now he's become the narrator for another story. So if you've developed a good character, they should have a voice within them. If they're cardboard, then they're just going to sound like everybody else.
Exactly.
Like, that kind of breaks into the development you put in your characters, world building, and just... Well, remember how we had stated that one point where when you write a story, sometimes the characters up and start doing their own thing and write the story with you going, wait, what? Those are good characters, and those ones usually have pretty decent dialogue that you don't have to stress about to finish.
One of the great bases, and we'll cover this a little bit later, but that helps for me to come with that, is that if I have two characters who are having a conversation with each other, in my mind and in the reader's mind, they should be able to differentiate between those characters when they're talking without me sitting there, that's George, that's Haley, and they're having conversations. If you can't tell who's who, I have failed. They both have separate experiences. They both have separate slang. They both have separate, tones.
They have different goals and motivations.
Exactly. So they're going to talk differently. We all talk differently. Some of us need limiters.
Funny enough, I still get people going like, we know who she is. The other three, sometimes your voices get muddled. But yeah, you should be able to differentiate between two speakers. And like, you're still gonna go like, Henry said blah blah blah, just enough to kick it off.
Yeah, every once in a while the reminder is good, because I know I'll be reading something, and the worst is when they put three people in the dialogue and I'm like, okay, I've had five different lines of people saying something, I don't know who's saying what at this point, and I will find that reference point of so-and-so did this, I'll be like, okay, so this person's this line, and I'll count backwards to who was saying what to the other line, so I try to figure out who's saying what. Then I have to reread the whole thing again, and it's like, okay, really, at this point, some help would be nice. Mm-hmm. And that frustrates the dickens out of me.
Yeah, at least tie it into an action if you're doing it that way.
Or limit it to two people.
But you can't always do that, but when, yeah.
No, but when it's literally line.
It should only be three, two people if you're doing that.
Yeah, but there was three people in there sometimes, and I'm just, I don't know who's saying what at this point. Shit.
And I've come across the three person, sometimes more, where it's just like, okay, I don't know who's saying what.
Yeah.
It's very frustrating.
And you don't have individual voices.
Yeah, we don't have the voices and in even your head that
the,
you do.
Even with the last, like, action that you've quoted, I still have no idea who's who. Because...
Well, even if they do have certain voices, sometimes just the things we say could be said the same no matter who says it. Right?
Well, I can get away with that if you know, someone writes with one of the characters using an accent. Then I can follow a little easier if it's just line.
Accents and slang.
Yeah, accents and slang, you know, they're really... I find them helpful in a book sometimes, depending on the situation.
But that doesn't mean you should just insert accents and slang just
for the
to,
shit of it. Yeah. No.
Well, that's like my trick-or-treat story. I had the whole Celtic slang accent thing going on, and that was a bitch to do. Because it was just like, okay, well, she's talking... And okay, I need to find slang for this, and I need to find slang for that, and I need to.
It's backwards building.
And she talks, and I'm just like, but this has to be slang that the reader should be able to figure out on their own. Same thing goes with my pulp story. Is there some of the 20s slang in there that I'm just like, I really hope that people understand what a frail is? You know, a skirt is pretty easy to understand. Frail as a woman, that's
it's
pretty
it's
chauvinistic from...
Yeah. Well, and when you write with slang, people have to understand that you're not just writing with slang. Most points you have to write the dialogue as you would normally for, you know, your typical Western speaking. And then you take these sentences that you want to turn into slang. And then you change words here and there to, you know, correlate to a slang. And then you have to reread the sentence to make sure that it still makes sense to what you wanted it to make. And then at that point, you have to more balance different words, or you even have to include an action line in there just to make sure that the slang actually worked. It's not a case of I threw it in there because it was flavor text.
Like the Western I wrote for pulp, I had written most people's dialogue and then went back and went, okay, he's over here. He's over here.
Yeah.
You know, and it just felt kind of dumb as you're like slashing letters and putting apostrophes
and
going.
Yeah, and then you do the spell check and your computer's all but like wailing at you in red and you're like, I'm sorry.
Well, that was
ignore.
Yanis's story for Abandoned Places. Some of his characters have slang and chopped dialogue and some of them have it significantly more than others. Mm-hmm. And you can tell who's talking when they're in a group. But holy crap, when they start getting into the really bad Southern accent, you're just like, what the F are you saying?
Honestly, just like in the Western I was talking about, I've got, even though I think there was two characters that don't use slang, are very proper, and they come off that way because everyone else is using slang around them. Mm-hmm. There's still another level lower of a guy even using worse slang to show that he's even like less educated.
The guttural street slang type of nonsense.
You know, like, it's weird that you can even adjust the amounts of slang or accents going around.
But again, that takes a heck of a lot of work. You can't just throw slang in to change one character A
and
to differentiate from character B.
You have to understand with slang that there are slang that's restricted to time periods and there's slang that's restricted to region.
Mm-hmm.
I will always remember I was watching Oprah when I was a kid, and I think I mentioned this in one of the previous podcasts. But they had at the time, they were talking about skaters, and they had this one lady on trying to explain slang to the mothers who were in the audience. And she's like, so bra is a female skater. And I'm just like,
oh God,
what?
That was a sentiment.
And then later on, you have Dog the Bounty Hunter. Hey bra.
Hey bra.
Hey bra. Hey bra. And it's...
Well, yeah, because before that it was bro, and before that, you know.
Yeah, no, bra is definitely...
But that's
evolved.
One of those cases where it's...
Know your slang before you just throw it into your book.
Well, for example, in Montreal, if you learn the proper French, you go to Montreal, they'll be able to tell that you don't actually know their French, mm-hmm. because their French is not the same as French in France.
No, the French in...
It's all slangy and slurred and...
France French regard Quebecois French as people in Alberta would regard the really coastal living Newfoundlanders.
Or like the Southerners of the States, I think, is something like that.
That's the best example I've ever heard. You and I speaking to someone who's born, bred, raised, never finished junior high, Newfoundland speech, that is what Quebecois French is to French.
But yeah, accents. Be very careful with them.
Because you never know who you're going to insult, for one.
And there are some people that will find it difficult to read. And if it is too hard to be difficult, they're just going to be really annoyed with your story.
Usually you can take them or leave them. I mean, if you look at Diana Gabaldon's Outlander series, if you can't do accents, never, ever, 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 ever bother thinking about picking up this series. Because she's in old Scotland when King Charlie was on the throne, and there's so many accents bandied about in that one. And the worst part is she's done her research, so that she has 2 to 3 different types of Scottish accents. So it gets very involved. Mm. Because she's done her research. Again, you haven't just thrown it in there as flavor text. She's done her research.
I think we've said this before. I can't remember if it was in the characters episode or not. But where, you know, if your accents are just so bad that people can't understand them, that could be because the person is speaking like that, mm-hmm. and people don't actually know what they're saying.
That happens. I've seen that in stories too, where the accent is so thick that the characters in the book look at the other person and go, what was that? Mm-hmm. Of course, then you get that little spurt of, huh, I actually got that.
So you may want to follow that up with the other characters confused as well.
Or at least one character says, oh, well, he just says this.
Just so the reader doesn't feel alienated.
Yeah, I know I have this frustrated later on the notes, but characters speaking different languages, I feel it's kind of appropriate to this.
Yes.
There's having done something where a character was speaking in a different language and being
yelled out, quote unquote.
Yeah. The thing is doing a different language in a story is really difficult because you're caught to the point where your guy understands it. If he's speaking a different language, then why are you putting it in a different language? And how do you convey that? It's even worse, like in my case, where the guy didn't know what he was saying. So it was just a bunch of Icelandic, and people are, and yeah, as Ocean said, people were like, why'd you put this in here? No one's going to understand it.
You can't even copy paste it to find out what it does say because it's in a different language alphabet.
Actually, one of the funniest things is the movie Thing. Mm-hmm. In the very, very opening, when the Icelandic people are chasing the dog to the other camp, mm-hmm. they're actually yelling basically the entire spoiler for the movie. Dog.
Which is that?
The Thing.
Oh, okay, yeah.
They're basically yelling, it's
the dog. Oh, right, right, it's the dog.
It's the dog, you know, so it's this giant, if you understand Icelandic...
you would know right away.
It wrecks the entire movie for you.
That's cheating.
But you gotta watch, I've seen different languages used in some stories, and generally, sometimes people will put the translation in italic parentheses underneath mm-hmm. or after it.
Like a subtitle.
Basically. I'm okay with that.
It generally works as far as long as it's not like huge pieces of dialogue and it's not like paragraphs upon paragraphs upon paragraphs
of
it.
That gets old fast.
Like, one of the recent stories I did with Samurai, one that had 2 tattoos that Mikoshi, thanks so much, grabbed me 2 that looked very similar but meant different things. And so I would put the symbol in the story and then right next to it, it was like dash, this is the translation of the symbol. Because... what's the point, right? If I just put symbol, no one's not going to know.
Flavor
understand.
Text.
Yeah.
And but the symbols play an important part of the story.
Yeah.
So you have to know what they mean and why. But at the same
time,
you need
to... Well,
if
you're not putting the description in, then it's nothing more than flavor text.
Like, I needed the effect of both. You can see these symbols look similar. And at the same time, you want to know what they mean.
Yeah.
It's the case, and especially if you're going to put a different language in your story, make sure that you either know the language... Or you talk to someone who knows the language. Because just spouting out random things in Latin is not going to get you anywhere if you do it wrong. because someone's going to come around who knows Latin and go...
Someone will Google call
Translate
you on it.
Is not 100% perfect.
Exactly.
No, it's really not.
Yeah.
Even when it's in Icelandic for my Cthulhu punk story.
Oh, God, you want to see something funny? I read a lot of tutorials online, and the majority of the best artists I've seen are Ukrainian. So, or... Ukrainian and or Russian. So putting a lot of their tutorials and stuff into the Google Translate, it's half hilarious, half just dismaying work because I have no idea what they're saying half the time.
But you also have to, I just actually thought of something for the slang, cultural and whatnot. One of the things I came across in one of my stories for Dungeon Grind was... they're basically pseudo dwarven Viking bears and their kings are Jarls. That's the title. But people who read it, who beta read and such, are just like, what's a Jarl? Why is this a title? Is this a name? What is this? Because you capitalize it in some points and you lowercase it in others. And the first time I ever actually came across Jarl, I did the exact same thing. I was like, what the bloody hell is this
Tarl in the Jarl?
Because at the time we didn't have Google, so I couldn't just Google it and go, well, what's Jarl? Oh, that's what it is. Okay. So I had to kind of piece it together through what's going on. So some cases we have cultural slang or terms that, because like in the case of your samurai story, you could throw in Japanese terms.
Oh, and I did.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't say he just had a sword. I said what type of sword it was.
I did
and
that.
And some people might not understand what a was whatever it was. I forget now. They might understand.
As soon as you went, well, I knew what sword it was. So.
What is it
Black
again?
Session.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Like, some people might not know what that is, but I'm hoping samurai and the fact that, oh, he cut someone with it, they're going to put two and two together. And if not, they'll look it up.
Well, that's, yeah.
See, I did something very similar to that in my story, Dead North, because I was using the Inuits. So I would research their weapons, their tools, I would describe the item, and then I would name it. Or I would do vice versa. So she would be using a three-pronged spear called a blank. You know, and it was actually kind of fun.
So with dialogue, one of the major issues that people have come across, and it comes up every so often on any writing podcast or any writing panels, is the use of said in your writing. Now, I'm pretty sure all three of us, I know Jan and I, because we've talked about this, were raised at school with using said is a bad word.
It's cheating.
I was taught in school, especially my creative writing class, don't use said. It's childish.
Write present tense instead and say say.
No.
No.
But it's a case of use an action or make sure their voices are distinct enough that you can tell who's talking, but just don't use said. Now that I've matured as a writer, I've come across the exact opposite where it's said, it's basically all these people trying to reverse that damage and that mindset that the high school and junior high teachers were saying, where it's, you can use said because the human brain now looks at said as essentially equivalent to like a period. It's just part of the punctuation, the mind glosses it over, and unless you constantly repeat said over and over and over again, you're not going to notice it.
See, but that's one of the cases where it comes in handy once in a while. You really shouldn't end every dialogue piece with it. It's
Yeah, I think that's where the issue comes up, is that he said this, she said that, he said this, she said that.
All you're doing to do is get that song in my head again.
Yeah. But it's a back and forth where you're just overusing the word and it sounds flat.
Well, we'll do that anyways with the new edit minion. It shows you how many times you use specific words and then you got to go through and cull a bunch of them.
But there's nothing wrong with using said. It's just as long as you're not repeating.
Overusing.
It. Yeah. You know, so-and-so, you know, blah, 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 said Ocean. Really? Said Yan?
No, but
now
I'm going to stop you there and go, asked Yan. Because she asked a question almost. She's like, really?
Well, yeah, you can ask it or state it.
And there, instantly, you've gotten rid of the repetition.
Right.
Which we already don't like. We don't like when you're repeating the same word over and over and over.
But see, my own personal thing is, I'm a stickler for if there's a question in it, then you're not, you don't have to say asked.
No, you can just like put already... queried.
Yeah, but we need to know who the second person talking
is. I know, yeah. So you can do that.
But in that case, you almost have, you know, so-and-so had a querying, you know, querying tone of voice. Well, what's
question.
Wrong with that? A questioning tone. Mm. You know, there's so many different ways to get around. He said, she said, he asked, she asked.
Exactly. But
it's
I mean,
back to the very, really quickly adverb thing. Like, there's better choices.
I'll be the first to admit that with said, I don't use it that often. I maybe use it once or twice in a story, and only when there's nothing else. And quite literally, it's,
he said...
And that was it.
Sometimes they just say things.
Exactly. It is. Well, I still suffer from the damage that we got in, you know, junior high school creative writing. Don't use said. So I will rack myself upside down trying to think of a way to do this sentence, do this dialogue without saying said.
Just don't use ejaculated.
That was the most awkward thing I've ever read. When someone states that when they've blurted something out, instead of saying blurted it out, they'll say ejaculated. That it'd be like, what? All I can think of now is, like, this person opened their mouth, said something, and gleeked all over the place. Like, no. Just no.
See, for myself...
what? You've never ejaculated everywhere with your mouth?
Yeah, I'm done.
Yeah, I'm done.
See, nope.
Anyway, you were saying?
See, for myself, I find I don't like to go back and say asked, questioned, blurted. I find I like to remove more of what's being said about the dialogue and just focus on the dialogue itself. If you already know it's two people talking back and forth, if they're not really doing anything important, or if there isn't anything you specifically need to show in their actions, you can just have them go back and forth. You don't need to put a nice bow on their dialogue and said, asked Yan, and exclaimed voice. When really, if he just goes, hey guys, exclamation mark, I'm already expecting him to exclaim something. If there's a question mark, I'm already expecting it to be asked or questioned.
Yeah.
And so I find a lot of the time, that'd
be repetitive.
Although I think on the bare level of the he said, she said, is that you're not going back and forth, said.
Yes.
And then the next level on that is just not always using said. We've got other words.
And I think that's the part reason that it's brought up at school is because at that level, junior high school, kids are saying
the most basic composition.
Because they don't understand.
And then I think you can even go a level up and, like I said, go back to just use the words of the dialogue of the character themselves. What are they saying? Should already have a large amount of meaning in what they are, what their motivations are, and all that, that you don't need to go, you know, you can always add, like, he rubbed his shoulder to show that maybe he is nervous about what he's saying or something.
The crack was wearing off, and you can tell by the way he scratched his arms. Furtively, he glanced to the side and asked his compatriot.
Now, as we were talking during...
Or you could have him stutter in that case. You know, he scratched his arm. I don't know what's... What? Yeah, like...
Awesome.
Well, as we were talking during the thing, that using actions also has the bad side effect of the fact that if your every dialogue is someone doing something, you can easily, quickly crowd your story, and suddenly it looks like two people who have drunk too many energy drinks, having a conversation while pacing around the room,
twitching,
picking things
flaring.
Up, putting it down, scratching themselves.
Yeah.
Oh my god, I love that.
Like, on the flip side, when you and I will stand and talk, we're not standing there, arms akimbo, and not moving a single inch as we sit and talk. Hello, how are you?
I am good. We need to have a conversation like this.
No, well, most people are moving, and they are using their hands and scratching while they're doing it.
But those are unconscious things. If you actually wrote down everything that you were doing, it would just be too much. It would just look like a bunch of twitchy idiots with energy drinks, you know, all the things that they're doing, and it
was
too much.
When we were talking there for that brief moment, pacing around, part of me just kind of in preparation for this was thinking to myself, and I'm just like, you know, I said something. Tarl turned 180 degrees and looked out the window. Blah, blah, blah. Ocean replied as he picked up his glass and went and got some water. But I think this, Tarl turned around 180 degrees and walked over to where Ocean was filling his glass. I know, Ocean said, as he took a sip out.
Yeah. It's too much.
Like, the only parts about that I could see is, like, Ocean walked in the kitchen to fill up his glass. And then later, like, followed. Yelled from outside the kitchen, hey, what? You know.
Yeah. I wasn't listening to you. Try it again.
And I think a lot goes back to pacing. A lot of times, there's so much, like, I said something, and then they move and move and move, and then the next person says something and move and move and move. And if those words really aren't describing or have an impact on what's actually going around them, why can't we just have dialogue that goes down?
Yeah. And that, see, and usually again, for the case of where it's just dialogue, having a little bit of action is nice to break it up and kind of remind people who's speaking and what they're doing. It also depends on where they are. I wrote a really nice scene on a unpublished story of two old friends talking at a coffee shop. They're not doing a lot of action. There's just the two of them. They're talking. And besides the odd taking a sip of their drink or looking out the window, not a lot happens.
I love this example that when you watch a TV show or a movie and they're watching someone, do they go to the bathroom every single time the person needs to go? No. Even though they're probably using it a regular amount of everyone else, you don't see them in the movie go to the bathroom all the time because there's no point to doing that. What the next movie you watch then, watch the main character and think, geez, he hasn't pissed in a while.
But I'm sitting in the theater going, oh God, end! Please end!
Now, on the case of action scenes, like having actions while people are talking, this also carries over to if you're actually doing an action scene, be it a fight scene, be it a gun battle, be things like that. I think people grew up a lot with your standard comic book thing where you've got so-and-so in this massive all-out cross-city brawl of two superpowers, and they're just talking each other's ears off.
So I was just discussing the other week how a comic is almost a weird one to do for action because you can't really flow. Like in a movie, you can watch an action scene. In a story, you can at least have a narrative, but everything is a piece at a time. But yet, it's one of the more action-oriented formats. But it's also filled with a lot of dialogue.
Mm-hmm. Well, right? I think the reason it's an action-filled format is because our mind automatically fills the blanks between one form and another.
It's like watching an animation one slide at a time.
Well,
right?
I was also thinking of like, those sentences where they put the first word and the last word like they're supposed to be, and the rest is just this garbled nonsense, and our brains just make up what the inside is supposed to be. It could almost be like that with comics, because we see the beginning and we see the next panel, and our brain just automatically fills out what the subsequent sequences are supposed to be.
And if they need some sort of detailed action, it's usually a bunch of quick chunk, chunk, chunk.
Yeah, or it's given in the narrative or the dialogue.
Mm-hmm. What was our whole point about comics again?
Basically, it's not a good example for the case of writing dialogue versus during an action scene. Because you can have dialogue during an action scene, but too much dialogue in an action scene slows it down. Because with an action scene, you're supposed to be shortening your sentences. Your marks are supposed to be really, really fast.
It goes back to pacing. You want things to be quick.
So having your guy sit there and go through an entire explanation as to, again, much like I was saying about that gumshoe thing, except in that case it was inner dialogue because it's first person.
It's the case of the James Bond villain monologue.
Yeah.
Right? They sit there and, oh, I'll tell you my entire plan, when really no one's going to sit around.
You caught me monologuing, you sly dog.
Or like Hank Scorpio, where he's just like, I don't want to hear you talk. I want to hear you die. You're going to die now.
I love Hank Scorpio.
Hank Scorpio was the best.
He was. They really knew how to do a villain, that one.
But yeah, if there is an action scene, sure, you can have your bad guy and your good guy duking it out with words, well, at the same time with fists and guns. But you have to make sure that if they sit there and talk, think about how they're sitting here at a gunfight, pointing at each other with their weapons and just sitting there, rabble, 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 bang, 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 bang. And then sit there again, stare at each other, rabbling off words.
Megamind does that well, though.
But Megamind is making fun of that trope at the same time.
It is, but they do it well.
Yeah. But you have to realize that in Megamind, they're also able to show the visual of it.
Yes, that's true.
Well, in a narrative, you kind of have to switch between words and
action. It would be hard to write that, but you could probably do it. Especially if you had that mockery in there.
But in the end, it's... I mean, even, say, someone who's a fairly good writer, like Butcher, when he wrote a Spider-Man novel, even during the fight scenes, like, Spider-Man's teasing the guy, but it's between the action scenes. So
there's that's Spider-Man's what Spider-Man does anyways.
Yeah, he's a very yes, vocal
but
character.
But in the comic, he's constantly talking even while he's fighting. Mm-hmm. In when he's actually having to write it down into a non-visual format, it's here's your action scene, here's your dialogue, here's your action scene, here's your dialogue. And it's not combining it all into one. It's not, you know, the case of it's just all cramming it all into one thing and wrecking while you're pacing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Pacing.
So, the use of names when you're doing dialogue.
Oh, geez. Okay, this is just a simple thing that a lot of people miss, and usually a lot of beginners. When you talk to someone, you only really have to say their name once.
To get their attention.
That's when you're getting their attention or directing their conversation to you. You know, it's high voice. Now we can carry on an entire conversation. I no longer go, you know what voice? You're right, voice. We should go down to the market voice and pick up some cantaloupes voice.
And I'm going
to
make a point. As everyone who's listened to this podcast knows, my real name is Tarl. Because I have an unusual name, I hate it when people use my name. When if people are in a dialogue with me and they use my name, it actually makes me mad. Because you're talking directly to me. I have an unusual name. I'm aware it's an unusual name. You don't have to use my name because it's unusual. You won't use it for normal people, but because it's unusual, people will sit there and throw it into their dialogue because they like to say it because it's unusual.
Because it's different?
And it's just really? Like, yeah, it bugs the hell out of me because it's like, why are you doing this? So, yeah, no. Just, you don't always do your dialogue going, hey, so-and-so, hey, so-and-so,
well,
hey,
this
so-and-so.
Just goes back to read it out loud. Mm-hmm. If it sounds stupid, well, you know what? It's probably going to sound stupid to your reader.
I was actually thinking, Batman. Just standard Batman scene enters a thing. There's the Joker. Joker. Really? You almost don't even have to do that dialogue. But it's for anyone who hasn't read it and knows that this is the Joker, right?
That happens way too often.
It was just one of those things I thought about. I was like, wait.
You just want the Joker to look at me and be like, we do this every time. Have you forgotten my name since the last time I held you psychosically? Like, really?
Well, there are occasions where you can use people's names, but they should usually be trying to stress a point. Like, Yan, really, we have to talk about your drinking.
Can we do it over a drink?
Yes.
Awesome.
So, basically, in the end, if you're going to write some dialogue or if you want to practice some dialogue, as we said,
do it out loud.
Do out loud. Go to places where people are talking and listen to how they talk.
Mm-hmm. Go to your friend, best friend, significant other and say, help me read this out loud. And if it sounds stilted or badly done, there's your answer.
Sadly, listening to other people's conversations won't help you when you're writing that Victorian era piece.
No.
Or Roman Greco times, but...
Or Scottish.
Unless you go to Scotland and listen there.
Oh, please don't. Yes. Sorry. I has English.
The other suggestion is get to know your characters better. Knowing how they're going to react to actions also leads into knowing how they're going to talk.
Getting to know.
And one of the things we were talking about on one of the character episodes, you can do the interview process, but you can also sit down and write. Like, if you can't really nail his voice, sit down and just write a dialogue of that character talking with, you know,
an interviewer or something. Yeah, you know, what's your favorite food? What do you like to do at night? You know,
then they're personal.
Tell me about the last time someone pissed you off.
Yeah, exactly. Because their voice will come out.
Well, it's also an acting trick of getting into your character. You know, interview that character.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I just forgot it was a voice acting trick. So.
Well, not just voice acting, just acting in general.
I've never looked at acting, so.
Well, if it works for voice acting. But get to know the character. The character, exactly. It's the character's voice after all, so.
Yeah.
Anything else?
Do we want to do the emails?
Yeah, let's do emails.
Okay. So, we got 2 emails.
Yay! It's like 200% bonus.
Yeah.
So first email comes from Dwayle, writes, as a writer, I feel it's part of my job not to tax the reader's suspension of disbelief beyond capacity. So I attempt to maintain scientific accuracy, or at least feasibility. However, a recent project required answers that science is currently unable to provide, and that may not come along within my lifetime. So, the question I would like to put to you all is, at what point and to what degree should realism take a back seat to the other story elements?
I think any point you've got the words science fiction or fantasy in there, you can probably have a little bit of license to suspend the disbelief.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's, for my own self, it's the slice of life kind of things. If you're really going out to left field, then I feel inclined to call you on it.
It's the case of, say, for science fiction, you have stuff like Star Wars, which is more of the pulpish science fiction versus, say, hard science fiction, which is that stuff where you have to explain every little detail of how your starship works. There's different levels of realism and feasibility that you can put into your story. That's the nice thing about being a writer, is that if someone's reading your story and they're enjoying it, their suspension of disbelief is going to be pretty good as they're reading, unless you really bugger it up, such as the case of bullets filled with nitroglycerin.
Boom!
More on that on a later date.
Well, at the same time, on TV shows and that, myself as a computer programmer, they always have the techie person going, oh, I hacked through this and I made this program.
IR hacks all the
time. And you're looking at their screen and going, right, yeah, what are you doing on IRC chat? You know? for people that aren't computer knowledgeable, their suspension of disbelief isn't broken. For people that are knowledgeable, you're screwed. But
at that point, you can work around it by not showing the blasted screen.
Well, what percentage of people actually know what you're talking about? And I think if there is a point where science can explain what you're talking about, maybe look into it. If you can just flub over it, go nuts.
Funny, with the show Numbers on TV, you know how they'll just have these giant equations and shit?
My old roommate was a math not genius. Not math genius. She was a math major, and she would be like, I can't watch Numbers.
My sister, she said at the beginning of the show they did really good, because at the very beginning they actually had real problems on there, because she's got this like love affair with math. If it's got numbers in it, she wants to do it. She has to do it. Junior high, she was doing and correcting grade 11 math texts for fun, right? She's been in AP since she was in grade 6. So Numbers comes on TV and they're giving an equation for the splatter pattern and a blood form from a sprinkler. And she went, I wonder if that actually works. And she broke down the equation, and sure enough, it worked. You know, the next time they put it on and the equation worked. And then there was another giant equation. She's like, that's wrong. I don't even need a piece of paper to see that that's wrong. And by the time they just started faking it, she was so done with the show. It killed her involvement for it. I mean, for me, it wouldn't have made no sense one way or another. But for her, it was, since this was her thing, they fubbed it up and it destroyed her involvement. And I'm sure the same thing goes for stories, you know, like with you, with, as I've always mentioned with earlier, with Latin. You know, if anybody knows any Latin, they're going to see you writing and they're going to be like, okay, that's an insult to me because I've done so much schooling on this and you screwed it over.
Yeah.
So when it comes to from the sounds of what you wrote down here, it sounds like you're writing something that's a little bit science fiction. There, you said that it may not come up in your lifetime, but there should be the basis of it in something real now. One thing that used to be told to me when I was in fine arts was, sure, if you want to draw a dragon, there's no dragons, but we have tons of lizards and things that look dragonish that you can learn how to draw a dragon from drawing them.
Even dinosaurs.
So the thing when it comes into, yeah, you might have a piece of technology that you might not know how it works, or you no idea how close it might work. In the end, you can look at something that works like it or the predecessor to that and use that as your model to build this technology. Look at all the things that Star Trek had in their first original TV series that are now, we've gone beyond. Tricorders, freaking communicators, the medical beds, all that stuff is something that someone looked at current technology and went, I bet you we'll have this in the future. And sure enough, we have now surpassed that.
Well, look, a good example. I mean, back when Star Trek first came out, doors that opened on their own, yeah, right. And now you come up to a point in our life where if the 7-Eleven door isn't automatic, we get miffed.
Or we run into it.
We run into it. Or we wonder what bear got into the store because the doors were turned off.
So I guess we covered that pretty well.
Sorry for my rambling.
I think my short answer is if it's something that's already in science, then look it up in science. If it's something that's not doesn't actually exist in this world, then go nuts. Yeah. As long as you can relate it back to something that people in today's life will understand what you're talking about.
Didn't Jules Verne do something like that? I mean,
Jules Verne invented the submarine before the submarine was out.
Yeah, basically.
Okay.
All right.
Oh, there we go. One email, though.
Next email. from Reckon.
Reachin'.
Reachin'.
Come on, people, phonetically.
From Reachin'. Sorry, Reachin'. Two questions. What are ways you can describe an anthro character to designate they are middle-aged or older, beyond fur, whitening, graying, moving slower, or getting scrawnier? Which you see in real-life animals. I can't think of many visual descriptors to I can't think of many visual descriptors to signify age. Things that work with humans, mainly skin, aren't obvious because the fur conceals that.
Well, when you get an older animal, when the skin starts to sag, you can actually see it in their fur, just with the wrinkles, with the body shape changing.
Aren't they getting scrawnier because they're not eating?
No, usually it's because the cartilage shrinks, their fat mass shrinks, the muscles end up atrophying just because it's not being used to the extent it used to be. So all in all, it shrinks. Mostly it's just bone density and the cartilage. Yeah. Which is why, you know, older people move slower, they're a little more frail. They technically are shrinking.
Cataracts,
yeah. Yellowing of the eyes, it depends on what species you have. They can have, you know, yellowing of the eyes. But I'm kind of with Rachel on this one that, you know, despite the graying of the fur and, you know, the moving around and, you know, the wizened look, there isn't much way to describe someone in a middle-aged, aged appearance for me.
Really, in my mind, think of when you're, well, how do you, barring the wrinkles and all that, when you portray a old character in a story, how are you portraying that character? Generally, it's their mannerisms that most people rely on rather than their physical appearance. You know, and yeah, it's some of the things that are mentioned, like the feeble movements, maybe needs a walker, maybe needs what, you know, things like that.
Long, gray, fuzzy tufts out of their ears.
Yeah, like...
That works for humans and anthros. Ew.
But that's the thing, is it's just a matter of you gotta take all the stereotypes of age and see which ones you can work with.
All of them.
Yeah, pretty much. Because there's gonna end up being certain parts that will work with the fur and won't work with the fur.
Can you still have wrinkles in the fur?
I think you can. Because if you look like a really old dog, a short-haired dog, they will have... Like, we used to have a black lab that was... He got older when he started losing the mass and his skin lost the elasticity. He had more wrinkling in his coat. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't his fur. It was literally just the skin.
So mix it with the human characteristics as well.
You just can't use liver spots.
Yeah.
Or can you? Well, then I guess you just have this freckled old dead guy.
Second question. If a story is in first person, how do you tell the reader what species the point of view character... what species the point of view character is while appearing neutral? You know, one usually doesn't say, I am a white male in first person stories in the same way I am a fox seems just as odd.
Sounds like a dating ad. I am a white male. I am a white fox.
I think in that case, because we've all written first-person stories, and there's tons of first-person furry stories out there, and it just comes with generally writing things like how you're writing your tale, or like how how you're writing your tale. Is it wagging behind you? Is it fluffy? Is it curling around me? What color is my fur?
Do your eyes have slits? Do your ears fold flat? Do you have canines? Does the sun do anything to your eyes? Does noise do anything to make your ears fold back? Are there any smells? Does anything appeal to you in your environment, species-wise?
See, I'm looking right now at this one story I'm working on where I just wanted to try what it'd be like with first person view. And now I'm actually kind of interested what points in here. And there's one person where he's talking with this female bouncer, and she looks at him, gives him a wink and a grin. She's like, "Have a good night, kitty cat." We already know he's feline now. You know, further down, there was something where someone calls him Stripes.
I know with
so how many cats have stripes?
My punked story, I just threw it in with how where she was. Mm-hmm. You know, she had the parasol to protect her eyes, and once the shade was up, her slitted eyes would elongate again. And
well, if sometimes you will say I am a white male or whatever. If you, I'm down. You can probably work it in. I'm down at in St. Kitts. I'm walking down the street. I may not feel comfortable because I'm a minority being a white male in a darker skinned environment.
Yep. That was funny.
How quickly do you need to know as a reader what species someone in a story is?
No, go ahead.
I try to have it nailed out pretty early just so that the person knows. Like, say my pulp story, Jericho Tanner. He literally states right in the beginning, he is a cat. He is a perpetually...
That one's first person?
Yeah. And it's... Yeah, that is first person. And it's nailed out pretty much within the first paragraph, he is a cat. Because it's one of the prime characteristics of his character. It is very important that he is a cat, and he is a yellow cat.
As a reader, I really like to be told what the character is within the first page, honestly. Otherwise, I'll just... My default is first-person male, because there's so many stories I read where the characters are first-person male, and it depends on the series or the type of stories I've been reading a lot. It'll shift my perspective to be first-person female, which is detrimental to the majority of stories I read. I mean, I'm assuming, you know, if the story I'm reading is first person. If it's, you know, third person, then usually I'm identified right away what the person in question is. But I find I make assumptions, and then it's kind of detrimental to the first couple paragraphs, and then I have to go back and reread it. So I like to be told pretty much straight off in a way that fits what the character is, you know. It's probably why I try to outline in most of my stories what the character is at the onset.
So basically, in the end, you can use things, elements like their friends or someone commenting on who they are. If you're the odd man out in an environment where you're, like, if say, trick or treat, and I had an Ibex that was in the middle of a town where Ibexes really weren't that common, and he had a Belgian rabbit friend, which is unique because she was Belgian. And it was just, I mean, there's things that we use to identify the people around us, and you just have to kind of use the same elements within a furry story.
Or you can use your environment, you know, when you're writing.
There's mirrors and glass.
Yeah, when you're, no, actually, I was more thinking when you're setting the scene and world building, you know, how is, if your character's outside and it's raining, how is the rain and the cold affecting your character? Mm-hmm. Is their tail tucked between their legs? Is it wrapped around? Do they not have a tail? Are their ears flattened? Are their ears, you know, most dogs can't fold their ears flat, let's face it, but cats can fold them right back. Cats' tails, you know, here's a good descriptor. It's raining. I hate rain. Why does anyone have to put me in the rain? Why can't it be, you know, a nice sunny day, something warm that soaks into the fur and makes me want to purr? Oh, well, look at that. My character's a cat. They hate the rain and they want to purr. Done.
They're pissed off. Their tail is now three times the size because it's puffed
fluffed up. And flashing side to side. Okay, well, either you're a neurotic squirrel or you're a cat because dogs' tails don't flail.
You're angry. Are you hissing? Are you growling?
Are your claws flexing in and out? There's so many descriptors you can do just with your environment to set the character base.
I think that's good.
Is there anything else you want to cover with dialogue or anything else? Meh. So we're still reading Summerhill.
Some of us are still reading
Summerhill. Some of us are still reading Summerhill. We've had some very interesting conversations that have happened on Twitter due to Summerhill. I'm almost done.
I've almost started.
I'm finished. The other one's finished.
I'm a fast reader. We'll be good.
So, not next episode. We've decided the episode after will be the review episode. So,
tune in for that. Your homework. Read it.
Yep. If you haven't read it, time to quickly go buy it from Bad Dog Books and get your electronic version.
Otherwise, let us know any feedback you've got, comments, complaints, questions, topics you want to hear, guests you'd like on.
Send us emails so we can mispronounce your names.
Yep. We apologize for any mispronounced names. We're horrible.
We're horrible people.
You can contact us at our email, podcast@fangsandfonts.com, or Twitter us @fangsandfonts, or use the Facebook page, Fangs and Fonts, or find us on
our Weasel, website.
So Furry, or for Affinity,
and Wikifer.
Fangs and Fonts.
And Wikifer.
Wikifer is just a documentation. Yeah. I don't think people would...
Really, we're out there. You can pretty much Google Fangs and Fonts at this point and walk into a haystack, and there we are.
So, if you like us, tell a friend. We always like friends. Have a good night.
I have friends!
There's so many jokes I want to say right now. I'm not going to. Good night, everybody.